Okay, this... just the syllabus for this semester is going around. All the detailed bibliography and all the detailed readings are on the original syllabus I gave you last semester. So if you don't have that, I guess Rossio can find some more. Yeah.
We have more copies.
Of this one, no, but we can make some up at halftime. Save the sheet. How much? There's some more there. And just to state the obvious, as you can see, even though we're halfway through the book, or nearly so, we actually have to move at a fair pace to get to the end of the book. That's just how it is. However, I've only laid it out for 12 weeks, so I'm assuming we will want to spend more time on some of these topics, inevitably on Antigone, the French Revolution, absolute knowing. These things never are as tidy as I hope they could be. For those who are registered, and I'm going to find out who they are in a minute, because only about half the people here are actually in the course, we are continuing on with the system of mini-commentaries, and the due dates for them are listed, week 3, week 6, week 9, and week 11, and they should be handed in to Rossio. That's all I want to say about any of that. Any questions about what we're doing? Should be straightforward by now. Okay, let me just see who's actually... there's always a massive drop-off in the second semester. So we'll see who's been brave enough to continue. Christina Acosta is a brave soul. Cameron? Here... Sarah Nicole. The machine will never allow you. No, it just won't do it, will it? Yeah. Okay. Thomas Pretz. Jacob Browning, I've seen. Matthew Congdon, I've seen. David Craig is here. Cameron Crane is here. Jason Fizet is here. Richard Flynn is here. Christopher Haddix. Katie, I've seen about. She is still about. Thomas Crowley is here. Catherine is here. Roxanne, I just saw. Joshua, I've just seen. Here he is, hiding in the corner. Alexei, hiding at the back. Thomas Stolen is here. Nostrellis, there you are. Hiding in the middle. You can hide in many places. Tang, I just saw. Mark Twainison is right in front of me. And Keith, I've seen. Okay. Anyone else registered who has a name I haven't called? Right. I did. Okay. Before you, there we go. Okay. So what I want to do today, as the syllabus says, and this may be a shock to some of you who thought you would have had an easy holiday, is I actually want to do observing reason today, all of it. It is easily the most dissatisfying or unsatisfying chapter in the book, which is not to say that it doesn't have an interesting underlying logic. Now, concentrate on the underlying logic, not the details. The reason why it's unsatisfying in its details, or at least to me, is because in it, Hegel gets involved in a whole variety of technical disputes around his time, especially in the long section on biology, where he considers what Harris calls the various forms of degenerative Schellingianism. You would have thought Schellingianism would be bad enough on its own, but to look at the degenerative forms from based on the writings of John Brown's medical theory, so you can just see this is just going to be a nightmare, right? So I don't do any of that stuff. This is, as I say, the only section of the book which I worked on and never found the details compelling, so I'm going to try to stay at the level of the structure of the argument, which is interesting. For those of you, of the various accounts of this section, the one I actually like best or find most compelling as giving a kind of sweep is one of the commentaries I really haven't mentioned to now, but is very interesting. It's Hegel's Quest for Certainty by Joe Flay. And I have problems with the overall structure of Flay's commentary. Quest for certainty? Is that what we're questing for? And he has this theory of interest. I have problems with that. And he also has a kind of odd pragmatist theory going on in the middle of all this. But nonetheless, at least for this whole chapter on reason, Flay seems to me one of the better commentaries in digging out what I think are the deep structures. Well, let's recall where we left off. And it's where the individual surrenders to the priest, surrenders his will, surrenders his knowledge, to the priest who, as the mediator between God and him, represents the possibility of reason, of universality entering the world. Right? Because the thought is that in order to have a mediator, a priest, a pope, right? The claim is they have in their possession God's knowledge. They are the voice of God on earth. So already in the person of the mediator, we have a unification of two things that we thought to be impossible, namely individuality, concrete, finite human being. Popes are, after all, real people, more or less. And universality. So the very idea of the mediator is already between the unchangeable and the changeable shows that these two things are really need not be extremes at all. And in a way, I suggested, that's exactly what Luther recognizes. If Fatso there in the Vatican can have direct access to God, and he is a mortal being, then so can every other person. That is, each individual can be their own priest. That's what the Reformation is about. And hence, each individual can have immediate contact via faith with the unchangeable, and therefore each individual can be aware of themselves, have a conscious certainty of being in possession of the truth. So the thought then, as Hegel runs it out, is that whatever a priest can say or do, any human consciousness can say or do. And as I suggested last time, this cuts in two directions, both in the direction of modern faith, in the direction of Lutheranism in all its forms. Faith, after all, is simply a form of certainty, one's relationship to the unchangeable. And that very certainty can also take on a rational form, that is, the self-certainty of the cogito. Indeed, necessarily, when Luther says, "Here I stand and can do no other," he is issuing a kind of cogito. And as I've tried to suggest in earlier lectures, the very activity of faith shows, demonstrates, that belief in God is logically impossible. Right? It's logically impossible because your self-assertion, "I'm in possession," is the denial that the other is the absolute authority. By having self-certainty, whether you call it faith or the cogito, you are disbelieving in any absolute outside yourself. And as you know, that's how, again to repeat, how I interpret the demon doubt in the first meditation. The demon doubt is an attempt to show, right, that there cannot be that the antagonism between faith and reason always ends up as a form of self-assertion. I can't deny myself. I cannot deny myself. So that moment of the cogito, the impossibility, no matter what God says, in order for me to think about that, I have to assert myself, means that you cannot believe in God. Not as an authority outside yourself. So, the notion of religion at this moment simply disappears. We'll have to come back to what it means. We haven't actually asked what religion means, and that's why there's going to be a whole section on religion. But the idea that there could be an external authority, that the universal could be absolutely external to me, is simply self-defeating. It's incoherent. Now, I dearly wish that the inhabitants of the White House would leave this so we could get out of Iraq, but maybe we ought to have a philosophical discussion with them. Anyway. So the thought here is that the self of self-assertion will always displace its object, which, of course, was what that whole chapter about the unhappy conscience was all about. The self kept trying to get rid of itself, to undo itself, and every time it did so, it found itself asserting itself. Right? And only that moment of emptying to the mediator, as it were, lets the connection between self and universality come about. The certainty of the cogito is just the reflective movement of radical faith. Hence, faith is always faith in self against whatever might trouble it. Now, from this it follows that consciousness no longer needs to take a negative view of the world. To maintain its freedom or independence in opposition to the world, the declaration of reason is equally to say that what I discover in my reason is the world. And Hegel says the new actual world, the world of Renaissance. So what remains of the impersonal creative father is nothing but the order of the natural world. So what reason is going to assert now is that everything is rational, or that thought and being are one, or that everything actual is rational. And of course, this is exactly what we find in Descartes. It is, after all, what I take to be the central moment in the meditations, the piece of wax. Because what the argument concerning the piece of wax concerns is that the world is not the way it appears to be, is not full of colors and smells and tastes and all that. That intrinsically, the world is made up of nothing but primary qualities. That the essence of the world, therefore, is quantifiable, and that, of course, the truth of reason, the highest truth of reason, is mathematics. So that there is an internal relationship between the powers of the mind, the capacity to do mathematics, and the nature of the world. So the notion of reason is not about that I have reason in my head or that there is something out there in the world. The notion of reason, as Hegel is developing it here, is about the relationship between mind and world. So, if that's right, then if we think of mathematical thinking or Descartes' method as rational in this new sense, namely being one with reality, then what reason is going to be doing here is to be seeking self-recognition in the order of nature. Of finding itself in the order of nature. So the claim now is that reason is all truth and all reality is to be understood firstly as claiming that there is no world other than the one in which finite consciousness actually exists in. That the order of nature is the, I want to be clear about this, the reality, the actuality of universality. It's the material embodiment. So being is the material embodiment of the universal. And hence, that order of nature is what must be known in order for reason to validate itself as being in possession of all truth and all reality. Or to put it another way, if nature truly is a rational order, then reason is its creator. And again, this is, I'll come back to what happens with this in a moment, but this is just methodologically just the way Descartes argues in his physics, right? He begins his physics by saying, okay, let's pretend, he says modestly, that there is no God, and let's ask ourselves, if we were God, how would we order and create and structure nature? Right? So the structure of reason displaces the creative God and says that there must be this ultimate structure going on. Or to put it another way, in the language of ficta, which I'm going to come back to in a second, there can be self-positing by self-certainty if and only if I posit the not-self as my rational other, as the resistance to, but also the external validation of my subjective standing. So the claim here is that practical reality is no longer about work or desire or enjoyment, all the things that it was in the chapter on the unhappy consciousness. It is reality comes about in virtue of knowledge, or that the world becomes fully actual by being known. That the world is just that place that, in being known, it becomes determinate in itself. So the idea of the self-recognition in the order of nature, we get in the end of paragraph 232, endless last sentence, where he says, "And thus apprehending itself, after losing the grave of its truth, after the abolition of its actuality, is itself abolished, and after the singleness of consciousness is for it, in itself, absolute essence, it discovers the world as its new real world, making all the noises about Renaissance, which in its permanence, holds an interest for it which previously lay only in transiency. The new world, the world, material world, now has the kind of interest for us that before we could not find in, that is, as a source of enjoyment of self-confirmation, that before was just a matter of consumption. For the existence of the world becomes for self-consciousness its own truth and presence. It is certain of experiencing only itself therein. That's the great thought of modern rationalism. So, rationality now is to be understood as a purposive activity in an appropriate world. So it's a structure of relatedness, a purposive activity in an appropriate world, which is thought now to be an adequate solution to the problem of an absolute standpoint, which was, of course, what, you know, the unhappy consciousness was looking for. And if I could really show, really demonstrate, really be sure, really be certain, really prove that mind and world were one, then I'd have inhabited an absolute standpoint. Because there'd be nothing else outside of it, and I would be assured of my relationship to the world, which is what I meant. Remember what I said, the absolute standpoint is about our standing in the world and our relationship to it. That each version of the absolute standpoint is an attempt to assure ourselves that we have the world that is truly our world, and that it's fit for our rational purposes. And that all of these are different ways of how we can stand in the world, have connect to the world with rationality and conviction. Or if you wish, have metaphysical faith in our place in the world. That's what every natural standpoint is looking for. Hegel calls reason instinctive here in various places, instinctive reason. In simply, what he means by this is that it is simply an acceptance, let's call it a naive or spontaneous or even thoughtless acceptance of the correlation of self and world. That, to put it another way, the self here presupposes the fitness of the world to my rational activities. Or presupposes that there is a rational structure which links my purposes to the world and to the life in which they are manifest. So again, reason here is neither only purpose or something in the rational individual, nor is it the appropriateness of the world or an external structure. It is here a living dialectical relation between them. It's the self-world relation that has now become explicitly the theme. And in all of this, I take it the background, I always think of the background of all of this, is Kant's third critique. And I think of it as Kant's third critique because what the third critique is about in varieties of ways is the purposiveness of nature. That is, the fitness of nature for our rational capacities. The very thing that Kant does not show and could not show in the first critique. So this is adopting the idea of the purposiveness of nature for our rational faculties as an underlying structure of modern rationalism from the get-go, from the beginning. That Descartes and Galileo must be assuming the purposiveness of nature. That Hume and Locke, in a way, are assuming and then get disappointed by that assumption, right? They assume it and then, so I want to say about both Locke and Hume, with a whole lot of recent scholarship, that they were both scientific realists who then had a skeptical doubt about the plausibility of their realism. That neither of them were empiricists in any strong sense of the word. They both assumed the reality of nature. Obviously, so with Locke. And according to Galen and Strawson and a bunch of other people, that's true of Hume as well. Reason, one statement formulation, is the relation of mind and world. Is the relation of mind and world. Not one thing or the other. So this is the stronger or more robust notion of reason that is kind of there. It's obviously kind of there in rationalism. Rationalism goes kind of wacky and anxious about it, right? And goes all theological and theodicies and Cartesian circles and all that sort of stuff. But all they're saying is that reason is not in the head. Reason must be the relation between mind and world. So there is a dialectical link between, let's call it totality and totalization. That purposive activity finds itself in the world as appropriate or inappropriate, and the world in turn is reflected only in the purposive activities of the conscious individual. So in the middle of paragraph 233, just to get this totality, totalization idea going. And you're going to hear, I mean, those of you who are fans of Castoriadis, this whole dialectic here is about constituted and constituting at various levels. Totality and totalization. That there's always, or as sociologists put it, between structure an agency. That we have to have, as it were, both moments going on all the time. And we're going to be moving, by the end of the chapter on reason altogether, to just that structure. That's just what spirit itself is going to be when we get there. A thoughtful working out of that relationship. But it's even here, Hegel says, but self-consciousness is all reality, not merely for itself, but also in itself. Only through, it is all reality in itself, but also through becoming this reality, or rather demonstrating itself to be such. So there's no truth without the detailed demonstration, the becoming, the activity. It demonstrates itself to be this along the path in which it first, in the dialectical movement of meaning, perceiving and understanding otherness as an intrinsic being, vanishes. And on it goes. Now that said, I think we know all this already. After all, isn't this just transcendental idealism? Isn't this the idea that there is no gap between the synthetic powers of consciousness and the actuality of the world? Isn't the whole purpose of idealism to claim, in a non-theological, no theodicy, no Cartesian circle, none of that kind of stuff, isn't it just to claim that there is a unity of thought and reality? And hence, again, and this is kind of unnerving, since we began the last chapter, the whole chapter on self-consciousness began with Fichte. Remember, A equals A. And he seems to be bringing Fichte back again with this A equals A stuff. Well, what are we to make of this claim about the role of idealism here? And what is Hegel arguing about it? I mean, one of the reasons he's mentioning idealism is to clue us into the fact that there's something like the standpoint of the present already. So we're not quite halfway through the book, and yet it seems to be claiming we're sort of nearly at the end of the book already, and somehow not. The question is, how are we, how aren't we? I mean, I've already claimed we are in a certain way already claiming the unity of thought and being. So what's the problem going to be? And at this point, he introduces a series of criticisms of Fichte and of Kant, which are important for structure of why he's going to do what he's going to do in this chapter. So the first thing he says is that what makes reason reason and not spirit is that the whole path we have followed to here conditions the meaning of reason. And this reason itself does not know. So the end of paragraph 233, or toward the end, he says, but the two reduce themselves to a single truth, namely that what is, or the in itself, only is insofar as it's for consciousness, and what is for consciousness is also in itself, or has intrinsic being. That's what we've got to now. The consciousness which is this truth, has this path behind it and has forgotten it. And it comes on the scene immediately as reason. In other words, this reason, which comes immediately on the scene, appears only as the certainty of truth. So that's the other reason why reason is instinctive here. That it has this notion of certainty, because it's forgetful. It's forgotten that there's been this whole educative process, the whole toils of the unhappy consciousness and everything that went before that, that was necessary to get there. Thus, it merely asserts that it is all reality, but does not itself comprehend this, for it is along that forgotten path that this immediately expressed assertion is comprehended. I take it that sentence is a summary of Hegel. That to comprehend your standpoint is going to be this massive act of memory by which you comprehend the whole path, the whole history of learning, by means of which you get to your present standpoint. And that idealism is a forgetfulness of that, and hence does not understand itself, and the manifestation of its not understanding itself is called certainty. It's not an accident, I think, that Fichte's, one of Fichte's, most interesting things is, that the argument against dogmatism or skepticism, right? And he's saying, you've got to be dogmatic, right? I mean, you've got to simply assert. So there is about self-assertion a kind of dogmatism. So the word certainty always hides a dogmatic suppression of its own historical coming to be. So, the deficit in contemporary idealism, in Kant and Fichte, he's now making explicit, is that it has no account of its own coming to be, and hence the history and genealogy which makes it what it is and gives it its real meaning. Now, of course, he's going to have to go some to show that. So he's offering that as an hypothesis. Hegel then, and this kind of raises a whole bunch of problems, one of which isn't in Hegel, but I think we may... Does it hold? One of the questions that Hegel's account here raises is simply this. What is the relationship between Genesis and validity? And I raise that question only because he seems here to be saying that there can be no comprehensive validation without an account of Genesis. And if that's true, then I would think that his own logic would be impossible. But I take it he's not thinking that thought here. Here are the actual criticisms he makes of idealism. First, in paragraph 235, Hegel criticizes Kant's attempt to read off the plurality of categories from the table of judgment. And the argument, it's a complicated argument, but the short version of it is that this derivation is obviously, as everyone argued, too immediate, too much shot from a pistol, hence an outrage on science. Second, I think this is the the deep critical moment here. What makes Kant and Fichte subjective idealists as opposed to absolute idealists is that the world is rational for them because anything that appears in it must be mine, must correspond to my ego, my transcendental subjectivity, to the transcendental unity of that perception. Where the mindness of judgmental synthesis is what gives the given its rationality. But, and this is the big but, the problem is that in every single such system, there is a remainder, an excess, a giving. A something that stands outside of the result of this and operates either as an input into it or as simply a constant remainder. So, of course, it's the problem of things in themselves, of extraneous impulse, of empirical or sensuous reality, of the given, of the transcendental object equals X, some notion of unconditioned otherness. And by virtue of this, in fact, all of these theories of idealism actually say something that is perfectly contradictory. Namely, I am all of reality, and I'm not. That the problem of things in themselves is always the acknowledgement of the failure of the fundamental idealist thesis, and it remains, in a way, the meaning of that remains inadequately thought. So, the bottom, the end of paragraph 238. Such a knowing is at the same time pronounced by the very principle of this idealism not to be a true knowing, for only in the unity of apperception lies the truth of knowing. The pure reason of this idealism, in order to reach this other, which is essential to it, and thus is the in itself, but which does not have within it, is therefore thrown back on its own self, onto that knowing which is not a knowing of what is true. This is just right what he says in the introduction. It's just that problem again. That there's always the problem of the unity of that perception and an external thing. Whether the thing, I love the fact, the thing, is called extraneous impulse or an empirical sensuous entity, or the thing in itself, it still remains in principle the same, extraneous to this unity. This idealism, therefore, he says, is involved in a contradiction, because it asserts the abstract notion of reason to be true, but directly comes to be for it in reality that is just as much not that of reason, while reason is at the same time supposed to be all reality. This reason remains a restless searching, and its very searching declares that the satisfaction of finding is a sheer impossibility. The notion of the thing in itself, for Hegel, is a version of the self-destruction of reason. Now, this is consequential, shockingly, for the rest of the chapter, because roughly Hegel's argument here is something about philosophical reason is dumb, let's get a better word than dumb, is thoughtless about the nature of its own failure. And it's thoughtless because we cannot see exactly why that failure comes about, how it comes about, what does it mean? And Hegel says, we can do better here than think about philosophy. That what we ought to really look at is not the bold assertion, I am all truth and all reality, but let's look at the actual scientific practices that try to demonstrate the truth of that proposition. That is, one of the things that Hegel wants to argue here is that the actual sciences, in a way, examining those sciences, or let's call it the actual practice of reason in the various sciences, let's call it the work of reason, is higher than philosophy. Because rather than merely positing both completeness and a thing in itself, reason sets to work demonstrating or proving it is at one with reality. And by seeing how reason does this and how it fails, we can gain actual insight into the meaning of that failure. Right? The thing is, what you get if you just go with this is the problem of things themselves is the debate between Henry Allison and Paul Breyer. Right? There is a thing in itself, there isn't a thing. And it goes back and forth, and it will go on like that forever. Right? Because it's an abstract philosophical argument without anything to rein it in, to condition it, to try to make sense of the problems. And Hegel's saying you're not going to get anywhere if you follow that path. That philosophy has to be, and he's going to say this over and over again in this book, non-philosophy, that is a comprehension of the world and certain activities in the world, including epistemic and practical activities, in order to make sense of itself. So rational activity seeks to prove itself through its activity. Hence, both for it and for us, that is, we philosophers who are looking on. To put it another way, natural consciousness, or the natural attitude, is now itself seeking to demonstrate the thesis that reason is the absolute standpoint, and the standpoint that gives warranted access to reality. And this obviously entails a change of method. Every time there's a change of chapters, there's a change of method. It's kind of one of the dizzying things about it. And there's a change of method because now rational activity itself, not theory, will work out its own presuppositions, which are given in the actual deeds of the rational individuals as they confront the world in their praxis, scientific practice, and we'll see later ethical praxis. That is, reason itself, in its actual practices, I have a cold, so at some point My voice just may give out altogether.
Pack up, go home. Reason itself is now in the business of constructing the relationship between mind and world. And that these practical activities are doing that.
And that there are certain versions of them that are self-evident. Which again, I think, you know, is that it's important when you think of Descartes and the piece of wax that you realize this is an addendum to his scientific practice, right? That it just as Galileo's attempt to explain the mathematizability of nature, both Galileo and Descartes were trying to work out the fitness, right, between mind and world. And to show that mind in its mathematical reach fitted a wholly mathematizable world. Okay. I'm not going to finish today. I can feel that. That was just an introduction. Any questions about that introduction before I lay out the structure of the chapter, and then we'll have. I need a little break because my voice is going out.
I'm kind of confused about the claim you made earlier about the problem with sort of the Kantian predictive program being one in which sort of the transcendental subject and transcendental object relationship is what we want to keep and what can't be forgotten was the history towards that culmination. I think that's what you said, if I'm not mistaken.
Not transcendental object.
I mean, the concept of the object probably being delivered to us by way of the constitutive powers of transcendent subjects.
Right.
But that's just what transcendental object is, and we still want to be.
Okay.
Now, I was trying to figure out what it would mean to try to do science and include the history to that point. So try to do mathematics as one who is aware of the history of mathematics and try to develop a result.
No. The thought is this. It's the actual what we're going to be looking at, to anticipate, is scientism. That is what Foucault called, you know, transcendental doublets, right? That each of the various sciences we're going to look at, physics, biology, logic, psychology, physiognomy, and then phrenology, is the structure of the chapter. Each of them are themselves various attempts to give a totalizing account of the world. And Hegel's thought is, that is, each of them, remember, it's instinctive reason, they're not doing the history. The history is our tracing their attempts. That's where the history comes in. So it's not that math should do its history. It's that we comprehend the meaning of reason by charting the various attempts by the various sciences to demonstrate their rational adequacy. That is, to demonstrate in their own scientific practice that they are at one with reality. That's the argument. So it's that history. So what I have to show you, what I have to demonstrate over... What I've got to demonstrate for this chapter to kind of work is why following this path of sciences, we suddenly discover that we cannot make sense of the world as reason by observing the world. Now we can only make sense of the world through action. So the structure of this chapter is about the relationship between, again, so we're right back to the problem of consciousness. So observing reason is the problem of consciousness.
but now souped up into a structure of reason. Right? So observing reason is souped up consciousness. Why is it souped up? Because now its activity is now going to be the attempt. The explicit attempt, as we know all scientific reductionism is, to show that it is, you know, the truth of everything. And it is in the nature of, let's call it, all the major sciences, that at some moment one wants to say, yeah, the whole world's like that. We can understand everything through physics. We can understand everything through biology. We can understand everything through logic. We can understand everything through psychology. That each science wants to be the queen of all the sciences. That is the transcendental regulator of the meaning of being in general. So what we're going to be doing is tracking the path. That's the history that he's interested in, right? Of those sciences, right? In order to see why there is, let's call it, a remainder, where the remainder comes from, and he's going to say roughly part of the reason there's a remainder is because reason here is contemplative or spectatorial, theoretical. You cannot grasp your place in the world by observation. Reason cannot be truly observation. And then we'll move to a structure of activity, of making the world. Turns out we can't make the world either. And then we'll get to spirit. So and that will give us another problem of history. So the history here is the history of the sciences. So the history of reason is the history of the sciences in their rational pursuits. And Hegel's claim is that's the history there's two histories. The history that we've already been through in the book. So on the one hand, there's the whole story about how we got where we are. Fichte and Kant make nothing of that. And furthermore, they make nothing of this history of reason. Does that help?
Sort of. My confusion stems from the fact that it's not clear to me how Hegel helps himself to the assertion that a particular science understands itself as unifying the subject and object, right? I mean, taking math as an example, they might say that this is a privileged manner of explaining everything, but that seems like a far step from saying that identifies subject and object as mathematical. Right? So it's, I'm sort of missing
the his claim would be when they say this explains everything, that's what the identity of subject and object is. That's one version of the thesis. Just like if you're, you read, it can drive you nuts. You read Davidson, and you think that, first order Becker calculus is the meaning of being. Otherwise, he can't use Tarski the way he does. Well, that's a section on logic. Why would someone say that, right? So the idea that reason and reality are one is an indeterminate expression. We don't know what it means. It just means, at the moment, a certain confidence of what I'm calling an internal relation between rational activity, purpose of activity, in some conception of the world, that there's a natural fitness. And how you articulate the fitness is your account of what the identity of thought and being is. Okay, so fitness itself is a kind of dummy term for all the various accounts of that.
Okay, well, that actually gives, it really says most of what I want to say, so I'll be quick about the rest. The structure of the chapter has just three parts. The first part of reason is this stuff on science, on observing reason. So I might call that discovering reason in the world. The second part of the chapter is called, by Hegel, the actualization of rational self-consciousness through its own activity. And the claim here is that rational self-consciousness is constituted by the activity of individuals, not merely observing the world, but by setting forth, by setting forth ideologies which are to guide their lives and to shape the world in accordance with reason. So that these ideologies are attempt to make the world rational. So part one is about finding reason in the world through rational inquiry. The other is about making the world rational through acting on various principles. And the third part of the chapter is that individuality, which takes itself to be real in and for itself, is to be given now by social individuals in an already established order of society, fulfilling theirs and others' needs, and trying to devise or to find a theoretical basis on which to make and test the laws of that society and that existence. So, in the last one, there is a society in which we're already in it. We're already in an interactive, cooperative set of arrangements, and what we're seeking for is finding out what laws we can use to regulate or test the laws that regulate our existence together. So, roughly, the scientific view is a way of is going to be discovered as too passive. It's the idea that we can merely discover the truth through rational inquiry. The second part of the chapter is going to be discovered to be too active. It's all about world making. And that Hegel is going to argue that reason can neither be found, cannot be discovered, nor made, created, but it is given as an already existing framework and constructed through the determinate acts of a community of individuals. And that will be just the transition to spirit itself. Probably said much too much. Let's, because unfortunately we are not starting at 8 o'clock, let's just have a short 7 to 10 minute break. We don't want to have a long break because we have to, we do some people in class at 8 o'clock. Yeah, a couple. Okay. So we do have to stop at 8. So let's just have a short break and we will pick up and I'll try to move a little quicker.